Tavis Smiley. You're listening to KBLA Talk 1580. Our phone number, 1-800-920-1580, 1-800-920-1580. So glad to have you along with us live for the show today. In this hour, why women are still taken less seriously than men, President Biden's nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, is making the rounds on Capitol Hill this week after speaking with senators, as she prepares for her hearing in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee to fill the seat of retiring Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, for whom she once clerked. I know this must be a full circle moment for her. Can you imagine that, having clerked for a justice on the Supreme Court and then being nominated to take his seat? Wow, that's a moment. I wonder, though, if she knows that the three female justices on the high court are interrupted four times more than the male justices. Real talk. It is Women's History Month, and every woman has a story. Maybe she tried to speak up in a meeting only to be talked over by male colleagues, or perhaps a client addressed her male subordinate instead of her. Despite the progress women have made toward equality as a society, we still fail miserably, and much more often than we might realize, to take women as seriously as we do men. In her book, The Authority Gap, Why Women Are Still Taken Less Seriously Than Men and What to Do About It, author Marianne Seacart provides a startling perspective on the unseen bias at work and in our everyday lives to reveal the size of the gap that still persists between men and women. And we give her say in this hour about the ways in which women are still overlooked, underestimated, and patronized. Marianne, how are you today?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I am well, thank you. It's good to have you on, and I'm glad I've got you for the hour. There's a whole lot to unpack in this hour, and we're going to get right into it. Let me start with this. I read that data a moment ago about the fact that the female justices on the Supreme Court are interrupted four more times than the male justices. When I saw that data some weeks ago, I can't say I was gobsmacked by it, but it did startle me, and it gave me pause. How did you interpret that data when you came across it?
And you know what you might have added is that 96% of the time they were being interrupted by men. I found it fascinating. I mean, we all know as women, we're much more likely to be interrupted or talked over than men are. It's something we just notice, we experience in our everyday lives. But to have it proved, not just for normal women, but for women right at the very top of their game. I mean, you don't get much more authoritative than being a U.S. Supreme Court justice. And if even they are suffering this sort of bias, that's pretty good proof that the rest of us do too, I think.
Yeah. How did you process that? How did you process that they're being interrupted by men, but they are women on the U.S. Supreme Court, to your point? I mean, I would think that if ever there were a place where that wouldn't happen, it'd be when you're trying to make an argument that you want to win in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. But to your point, it happens there as well.
Yeah, so it even happens with male advocates interrupting justices. And you'd think the advocates would know it was not in their interest to offend the person, you know, who's going to make the judgment, wouldn't you? But they still couldn't resist. It's this sense, not all men do this, but there is a sort of sense, I think, of male entitlement to more speaking time than women. And I think this starts very early on in life. So some studies have shown that teachers are between 8 and 9 times more likely to call on boys to speak in class than girls, or boys to answer questions than girls, or boys to come up in front of the class than girls. And girls are rewarded for being quiet and well-behaved, and boys are rewarded for speaking out. And I think this nurtures in them this sort of sense that boys are somehow entitled to a disproportionate amount of speaking time. And this carries on then into later life. So every single academic study of speaking time, at least in public settings, like at work, shows that men talk more than women. And there was one lovely one that which really made me laugh. Men and women were given 2 paintings to look at, and they were asked to talk about these paintings for as long as they liked. And the women talked on average for just over 3 minutes, and the men talked on average for 13 minutes, in other words, 4 times as long, But even those figures weren't accurate because three of the men were still talking when their 30-minute cassette tapes ran out.
Well, let me say this at the start of this conversation. I promise I'm watching the meter. I promise to give you way more speaking time in this hour than I'm going to take. I promise. You'll get more time to talk in this hour than I will. I'm going to ask some questions and get out of the way and give you all the time you need to unpack what you downloaded in this book called The Authority Gap. Let me just ask this question right quick. And I want to come back to that teacher example, what happens in the classroom in just a second. I'm fascinated by that, and I'll tell you why in a minute or so here. But let me start with this, Marianne. When you say that men can't resist, that's a powerful phrase, that we just can't resist, even in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, when we're talking to female justices, what is it about our nature that makes it impossible for us to resist the pull or the conditioning that we have to just over-talk women?
I think there is an innate sense, not in all men, but in a lot of men, of superiority over women. Mm. And, you know, this comes from millennia of patriarchy, of men genuinely being in charge, of almost all religions telling us that men ought to be in charge and that women ought to be subservient. And therefore, I think a lot of men, not all men, but a lot of men feel really quite uncomfortable if a woman is in authority over them. And so they need to prove themselves by jumping in and interrupting and asserting their own power so they don't feel so bad about it.
Hmm. The other thing I said I wanted to come back to is just the example you gave us of what happens in classrooms. The thing that I find startling, there's that word again, the thing that I find arresting about that particular data point, Marianne, is that most teachers are women. So when you say that they call on boys more than they call on girls, what's that about? What's that about? Because, again, most teachers in the profession happen to be female.
Well, women are just as biased against other women as men are. Mm. So this is not a man-bashing book. This is saying to all of us, we need to think about this unconscious bias, which has been lodged in our brains by, as I say, you know, centuries of tradition and seeing a world around us in which basically men are still in charge in most walks of life, and probably growing up in a family in which our father and more than our mother worked probably more than our mother, maybe had more authority at home than our mother. And so this creates this sort of stereotype, you know, the unconscious bias in our brain, that we just much more readily associate male with authority, and that's women as well as men. But I think also when it comes to teaching, what tends to happen is boys are much more likely to put their hand up before they've even thought of the answer. Girls tend to be more tentative and don't want to put their hand up unless they're sure of the answer. Boys can call out an answer in class. I was reading a book. I mean, I cite a book where the academics concerned spent hours and hours and hours observing classroom behavior. And this is what they saw. And they said that boys were allowed to shout out answers. If girls shouted out an answer, the teacher was much more likely to say, put your hand up if you want to speak. So they might not realize they're treating boys differently, but they often are. And sometimes it's a disciplinary thing. Sometimes, you know, the boys are playing up or chatting to each other, and you call on a boy to answer the question to sort of bring him back into the class. But they do just get much more attention on the whole than girls do.
Mm. I guess it shouldn't be surprising, but it is. It's always interesting to me to take note of the ways in which we are conditioned as human beings that has so much to do with the way we behave as we age and as we grow older. But so much of our behavior or misbehavior, as it were, is all about conditioning. And we'll talk a lot more about that in this hour. Pleased to have Marianne Seagart with us in this hour. Her book is called The Authority Gap, Why Women Are Still Taken Less Seriously Than Men and What We Can Do About It. More with Marianne when we come forward on KBLA Talk 1580.
We've got a lot to talk about.
Good thing we've got 3 hours.
More of Tavis Smiley when we come forward. Let's unpack a little bit more with Tavis Smiley. The conversation continues right now. Right now.
Our guest in this hour is author Marianne Seagart. Her book is called The Authority Gap, Why Women Are Still Taken Less Seriously Than Men and What We Can Do About It. I was sitting there, sitting here, Marianne, during the break, and a few things crossed my mind. Let me jump to them right away. I start with this. Because we left off discussing this notion of conditioning. If so much of the way we behave or misbehave, as it were, has to do with our conditioning, and you were giving examples earlier in this conversation about how this starts so early in our lives, To arrest this sort of behavior, to arrest this development, is a tall task if it starts so early and we're conditioned in these ways.
Yeah, it depends very much on how we're brought up, I think. And if we're brought up as girls to believe that we're equal to boys, we're going to feel more confident, we're going to be more ambitious, we're going to have higher self-esteem. So as parents, it's really important, I think, that you treat your boys and girls, your sons and daughters, equally. But one of the most depressing pieces of evidence I came across when I was researching the book was that if you ask parents to estimate their children's IQ, they will estimate their boys on average at 115 and their girls at only 107, despite the fact that girls develop faster than boys, have a bigger vocabulary than boys, do better at school than boys. In fact, they do better all the way through school and college, and right up through PhDs, girls outperform boys academically. And yet their parents still believe their sons are cleverer. And they're more like, American parents are 2.5 times more likely to Google, "Is my son gifted?" than "Is my daughter gifted?" Even though girls actually make up 11% more of the gifted and talented streams in American schools. So boys are growing up subliminally absorbing this notion that somehow they're cleverer than girls. And girls are growing up subliminally absorbing the notion that they're not as clever as boys. Even though we know that actually the IQ distribution is identical between boys and girls and men and women, except at the very extreme ends of the spectrum. And the same researchers asked adult men and women to estimate their own IQ, and they found that adult men estimated it on average at 110 and adult women at 105. So men are incorrectly believing they're cleverer than they are, and women are incorrectly believing they're less clever than they are.
Yeah.
And this happens really, it starts really young. So there was a study done of 5, 6, and 7-year-old kids, and they were told, first of all, the researchers said, there's this co-worker at work who is really, really smart and knows the answers to all the questions and is really good at solving problems. Who do you think it is? And they were showed photos of men and women. And at the age of 5, girls would choose a woman and boys would choose a man. But by the ages of 6 and 7, the boys were still choosing the man, but so were a lot of the girls.
Mm.
So there's this notion, by the time you get to about 6 or 7, that the really, really smart one is going to be male rather than female.
Mm. That's fascinating data.
And they were then asked to choose teammates for a game for really, really smart kids. And again, the same thing happened. At 5, they would choose their own gender. And by 6 and 7, they were starting to choose boys more than girls.
Mm.
And it's a lot to fight against. You're right.
No, it is a lot to fight against. And what do we think, what did you learn about what causes that shift between those ages where girls start to believe the same lies?
Oh, I don't know. I guess it's just being more exposed to the sort of stereotypes around us. I mean, it's partly if you look at books, children's books, children's movies. These are starting to change, thank goodness, but only in the last few years. You know, children's books used to be much more likely to have boys as the main character, and the boys would be doing the clever things, and the girls would be sort of tagging along. And it was the same in movies and TV programs. That is, as I say, thankfully starting to change, so that may help.
Yeah. I wonder whether you think that men would behave better, that men would behave differently if they knew how they were misbehaving. I mean, my point is, it's hard to hear the data that you're bringing forward in this conversation and that you detail in your text and not say, wow, am I one of those guys? It's particularly if you're a father of a daughter. What are the ways in which you are maltreating, unwittingly, unknowingly, your daughter and not giving her the respect that she deserves because you're not even aware that you're doing it? So I'm asking whether or not you think that men would behave better, behave differently, if we knew the ways in which we were disrespecting women.
Oh, yes. I think most men would. And I really hope that that they either read the book or, you know, read about it and start to look at the way they're behaving. Because I think, I tend to divide men into three, okay? There's about a third of men, in my experience, who are fantastic already, and they really treat women with equal respect, and they listen to women just as attentively as they do to men, and they read books by women as well as books by men. And we love those men. We really notice it. We really appreciate it. And thank you so much. And then at the very other end of the spectrum, there are the dinosaurs. You know, they've got not so much unconscious bias as conscious bias. They genuinely believe they're better than us. And they treat us condescendingly. And they're not interested in what we have to say. And they don't listen. I don't think they're going to read my book. And I don't think they probably even want to change. But I think there's a great mass of men in the middle who are not actively malign. They don't want to be sexist. They just don't notice that what they're doing contributes to this authority gap. And they don't notice because it's what they've always done. It's what the men around them often do. It's just become normalized. And I think that if they had their eyes open to it, they would start to behave differently. And they would stop interrupting women more than men. And, you know, there are men at meetings who will listen to what other men are saying. And then as soon as their female co-worker starts talking, they're checking their phone for their emails, you know, and they will stop doing that sort of thing once they realize how insulting that is. But they do need to be aware of it in the first place.
Mm. That raises two questions. How do men who are sexist and patriarchal in those ways realize that they are, number one? And number two, once they realize it, what do they do about it?
Well, I think it's like, well, how do they realize they are? I think by having, you know, by reading about this sort of thing, looking at the behavior, checking their own behavior and seeing whether it matches. And then what can they do about it? I think it's a bit like learning not to slump at your desk or to stop biting your fingernails. You know, you just have to catch yourself every time you're doing it and think, ah, I'm going to stop. You know, if I'm about to interrupt a woman, no, I'm going to bite my tongue and let her finish before I chip in. You've just got to, you know, if I'm walking up to a man and a woman standing together, I'm not automatically going to address the man first this time. I'll talk to the woman first instead. You just have to be much more aware, I think, of what you're doing. And the more you correct for it, the more natural it then becomes and the more automatic it then becomes. You can just train yourself with a little bit of effort, not a huge amount.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I liked about your book, Marianne, is the way you approach these notions, these intersections, I should say, these intersections of race and class biases. And you do a really good job of sort of addressing that. And I was thinking, as I was going through the book, excuse me, I was thinking about Justice Brown Jackson, who I referenced earlier in this conversation. So we all know that President Biden has nominated the first black woman who will once confirmed, and I'm going to claim that, not say if, once confirmed, she'll be the first,
right?
Yeah, the first black woman to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court. Let me circle back to the data we talked about earlier, that the female justices on the court now, Kagan, Sotomayor, and Amy Coney Barrett, the newest one, they get interrupted four times more than the male justices, but they're all white women. Now you got a black woman coming into court, and you have all these white males, these lawyers, who are going to be arguing before the Supreme Court, and I dare to think how many times she's going to get interrupted as a black woman, given the way this society, since 1619, let's go back to there, the ways in which this society has disrespected black women as compared to white women. All women get disrespected, but there's a whole other thing, as you know, about the ways in which black women get disrespected. So it's going to be fascinating to watch how she gets treated, or maltreated as it were, as a member of the U.S. Supreme Court. So I was thinking about that in connection with these intersections of race and class biases. There's no question there deliberately, but I wanted to put that out and let you take it anywhere you want to take it.
Yeah, no, it's going to be worse for her than for the other three. It's already worse for Justice Sotomayor. She gets interrupted more than the two white justices. And I expect it will be even worse for the new one. I hope she does get confirmed, by the way. It will be. And, you know, black women are nearly twice as likely as white women to say that they have to provide extra evidence of their competence. And white women are already twice as likely as men to say that. Black women are even more likely than white women to say that people are surprised at their ability. So they experience the authority gap even more than white women do. And they also are much more likely to say they don't feel supported at work by their superiors, that their manager isn't trying to progress their career, that they don't have contact with senior members of the leadership team. Again, much more than white women to say this. So, and the trouble also for black women is that the racial stereotypes get overlaid on the gender stereotypes. So, you know, you suddenly become an angry black woman. As if it's not bad enough that you're a woman, suddenly you're an angry black woman. You know, even Michelle Obama found that, didn't she, at the beginning, mm-hmm. before people really warmed to her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you might be the sort of submissive Asian woman. People just expect these things from other people without questioning it. I would really love us to try to get, you know, just treat everybody like an individual and treat them as an individual person equally and not overlay these ridiculous stereotypes on them. Mm. And then another problem for women of color is that if they do get hired and promoted, and, you know, they really deserve to be, people then say, oh, well, she was just a diversity hire, or it was just affirmative action. So even if you're completely brilliant as a woman of color, that's often not going to be recognized because people will think you were just appointed to that job because of affirmative action. So it really is, you know, a lot worse for women of color, for working class women, for women with disabilities. The authority gap is wider still.
Speaking of working class women, there are many who believe, I'm now talking primarily about men, of course, although there are some women in this category. As you mentioned, women can be just as bad as men when it comes to buying into these lies, but primarily discussing men for this particular point, there are men who believe that women are naturally less well suited for certain careers. And if you believe that coming out the blocks, then obviously you're going to treat women with disrespect.
Yeah, but we're just not, are we? I mean, the only career we're less well suited for, I think, is weightlifting. You know, I mean, these days, and we're even pretty good firefighters, by the way. We can get into through windows that men can't. You know,
yeah.
Even something like firefighting, we're pretty good at. I mean, you know, there is no evidence to suggest. I've got a whole chapter just for the skeptics, and I've said to other people, you can skip this chapter if you like. But for the skeptics, I've got a whole chapter proving that women are every bit as competent as men and as suited to careers as men, except for ones that involve huge upper body physical strength in every mm-hmm. other respect. We're just as good and in some better. You know, I don't want to claim female superiority in all areas, but, you know, there have been huge studies of leadership, for instance, showing that on average, only on average, women make slightly better leaders than men. And in fact, people who work for female leaders tend to rate them more highly than they do male leaders, but the male leaders rate themselves more highly.
Yeah, not surprised by, so, not surprised by that reality.
So I mean, I think if you believe that women are less suited to certain careers than men, then I think you just need to re-examine your prejudice,
yeah.
I'm afraid. I'm sure you don't, personally.
No, not at all. That's why I have so many women who host shows around here on this station, because I know they are just as smart, if not smarter, than we are. So my mother told me many, many years ago, if you want something done right, get a woman to do it. And so when I want something done the right way, I ask a woman to do it. And so that's why there's so many brilliant hosts on this station who lead their own shows and amplify their own voices, and we're delighted to have them as colleagues here at KBLA Talk 1580. When we come forward on this station after news and traffic, we have been talking about the ways in which women are disrespected in the workplace, but Marianne also talks about the ways in which we disrespect women online, the online bias, the online abuse that women are subjected to. I want to talk also about the media's role. Madison Avenue, the way we market things, and the ways in which women are disrespected and exploited in that kind of outreach. A great deal more to talk about in this hour. Her book is called The Authority Gap, Why Women Are Still Taken Less Seriously Than Men and What We Can Do About It. And I promise we'll get to that part, what we can do about it. Her last chapter is called No Need to Despair. So later in the hour, we'll get to why there's no need to despair and what we can do about this with our guest, Marianne Sieghart, on KBLA Talk 1580.
Black better. Better. Tweet it. Tell it. LA finally has a black-owned talk radio station. And it's unapologetically progressive. KBLA Talk 1580. History is now. And you are part of it. Thank you for spending your days with KBLA Talk 1580. Let's jump back into the conversation. We've got a lot to talk about.
Indeed, we do. We continue our conversation now with author Marianne Sieghart. Her book is called The Authority Gap, Why Women Are Still Taken Less Seriously Than Men and What We Can Do About It. Marianne, I could have started our conversation with this question, and I think I get it. Of course, I've seen the book. But why did you call the book The Authority Gap?
Well, I realized it was all about authority in two meanings, both authority in terms of expertise, how much we know about things and how good we are at doing them, but also authority in terms of power and leadership, because we still feel uncomfortable seeing women in positions of authority. You know, it's really interesting when you look at American politics, for instance, that when Hillary Clinton was running in 2016, a lot of people were asked, would you vote for a female? Would you vote for a woman president? And they'd say, oh, sure, of course I vote for a woman, but just not that woman. Because I think there's something about her. I just don't like her. And then next time round, 4 years later, there were enough women for a basketball team running for the Democratic nomination. And still people were saying, oh, sure, I'd vote for a woman, but not those women. I just don't like them. And you start thinking, well, actually, what are the chances of all those women being genuinely unlikable? Isn't it, in fact, telling us more about ourselves that we just don't like the notion of women seeking power? And there are academic studies showing that power seeking is really disliked in women. But in order to run for office, that's exactly what you're doing. You're seeking power, aren't you? Mm-hmm. Using power for the good, one hopes. But we don't have that feeling about power seeking men. And so women have a real disadvantage when it comes to positions of authority, because it just makes us feel uncomfortable. And it's partly to do with these stereotypes, that these sort of niggly, old-fashioned stereotypes that are still lurking in our brains, that tell us that women ought to be gentle and warm and kind and nurturing and unselfish and unassuming and unthreatening and uncompetitive. Mm. Whereas men are supposed to be confident and assertive and determined and show leadership. And if women act like those old-fashioned stereotypes, no one's going to take them seriously at all. Mm-hmm. They're just going to roll over them, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if women want to be taken seriously, particularly at work, they have to be confident and assertive and show leadership. But as soon as they do, people think, oh, no, they're behaving like men. That makes me feel really uncomfortable. I don't like that at all. And therefore, they start to dislike these women, and they'll use words about them like, oh, she's quite abrasive, isn't she? Or she's strident or aggressive, bossy, overbearing, bitchy even, ball-breaking even, mm-hmm. you know, scary. Why scary? Just because she's competent and confident. Yeah. You know, why is that scary?
Finish your point. I mean, I don't want to interrupt you. Forgive me for that, please. I was not trying to interrupt. finish your point, please.
Thank you, David. Yeah, so women have this really narrow path to navigate between being not confident enough and therefore disrespected, or confident enough and therefore disliked. And that's really difficult. And you might say to women, oh, well, you just grow a thicker skin. Who cares if people like you or not? Well, actually, when it comes to work decisions, likability is incredibly important, and much more important for women than to men. When it comes to being hired or being promoted, likability is something that male hirers in particular care about when it comes to hiring women. Mm-hmm. So they will judge men much more on the basis of, you know, competence and achievement and potential. But with women, they've also got to be likable. And so how do you make yourself likable? How do you make yourself confident enough to get the job in the job interview, but not then to be disliked? And the only way through, actually, is for women to layer an enormous amount of warmth on top of their personality to try to mitigate this dislike that they will otherwise, encourage in people. I mean, not deliberately encourage, but produce in people. And so women learn, sometimes subconsciously, but they realize they've just got to smile a lot, and they've got to leaven everything with humor, and they've got to be incredibly emotionally intelligent, be really careful not to dent any male egos, you know, don't be threatening, be a little bit submissive. And you've got to do all this just in order not to be disliked if you are a competent, authoritative woman. And it's exhausting. I mean, it's a huge burden that men don't have to bear. It's exhausting. It's something that some women aren't particularly good at, and why should they have to be? But that's the way the world is, sadly. Yeah.
We had a moment here in studio a couple seconds ago when I interrupted you. All the men in my studio, in my control room, looked at me, and their eyes popped out of their head. No, no, no. The one thing I said I was not going to do in this hour, I am not going to interrupt Marianne, because I don't want to get called on that. And this is radio, and obviously I can't see you. You can't see me. So I thought you took a pause there, but I did not mean to interrupt. And I said, Tavis, do not interrupt Marianne in this hour. That said, when you were unpacking this definition of authority and why you called the book The Authority Gap, and you had two reasons, of course, one about expertise, the other about power. And you used the example of Hillary Clinton. Interesting, I was in a conversation, I guess on Sunday, it was an event I had to go to, and I was in a seated at a table with a number of high profile, really, really intelligent, brilliant black women. And this conversation sort of came up. And the consensus at the table was that Kamala Harris, and we all expect because she's vice president, she wants to be president, of course. And whether Joe Biden runs for re-election or not, he says he's going to. He may not, given his age. And we'll see where we are in 2024. But Kamala wants to run. We all know that. She ran before. And that's how she became vice president, of course. And we were discussing, Marianne, the other day, that Kamala Harris, we predict, this is a table full of black folk, is going to be treated or maltreated in the same exact way that Hillary Clinton was. And what you're going to hear repeatedly from people is that they just don't like her. She's just, I'll vote for a woman, but not that woman. So I think that Kamala is going to get the same kind of treatment that Hillary Clinton got when she ran. We will wait and see how that all plays out a few years from now. But that was the consensus at the table, that if Hillary got that, Kamala's certainly going to get it, and she's going to get it in spades. We will see if we're right about that, but that was the consensus at the table. I wanted to raise that because that thought came to me while you were talking about the ways in which we push back against Hillary Clinton on the power notion. But speaking of power, you know the old notion, Marianne, that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That is true for men. That statement only came to be because of men who got power and were corrupted by it. Are women corrupted by the power that they do get?
On average, female politicians are less corrupt than male politicians. I mean, studies have been done on this. That's not to say there aren't any corrupt women. Of course there are. We're not perfect. But I think we are probably less corrupted than men. It's certainly true, you know, when you look at examples of people who've been caught out in, you know, bribery cases, they're much more likely to be male than female. So I also think that women have a different relationship to their ego than men on average. You never really hear of a swaggering woman, do you?
Mm.
Women don't sort of strut about in the way that some men do. And again, it's partly because of the way we've been socialized. In fact, I think it's almost entirely, though maybe testosterone plays a part too. But I think women find it easier to express their vulnerability. In fact, if you look at girls and indeed adult women, the way they bond is actually to admit vulnerability. So girls or women will say, oh, I'm useless at math, or I hate my hair, or my legs are too short, or something like that. And that's actually how they bond with each other and make friends. Whereas if you look at boys playing together and talking together, they're much more likely to use a form of sort of competitive boastfulness.
Mm.
You know, oh, my dad's got a better car than yours, or I score more goals this season than you have.
Mm.
And that's why I think, you know, men are often sort of, what are they doing? They're sort of comparing the size of their, I'm going to say egos, because it's radio, with each other.
Yes. Thank you for that. Thank you. Thank you.
And women don't. Women do the opposite. So I suspect that probably makes us more empathetic and leaders with less sort of bravado than men. It's been really interesting during the pandemic to see a certain type of male leader. I'm not talking about all of them. But I think you can, when I describe them, I think you'll know who I have in mind. The ones who are sort of bombastic and exaggerating and, you know, sure, they're never going to catch COVID because they're that sort of man, you know, and their country is never really going to suffer from this pandemic because they're exceptional. And you look at the death rates in, I'm going to say, the UK, the US, mm-hmm. Brazil, mm-hmm. Turkey. So you know which leaders I was talking
sure,
about.
Sure, sure.
And how much worse they've been. You know, the sort of blustering, you know, very ego-driven male leaders. And how much worse these death rates have been than in countries like New Zealand or Germany or Taiwan, run by female leaders
mm-hmm.
who locked down much faster, who weren't embarrassed to wear masks, who put people's lives, who prioritized human lives ahead of the economy.
Yeah.
They were just much more successful at it, weren't they?
Yeah, they were and are. And I'm glad you stuck with his big ego as opposed to where else you could have gone. I digress on that point. When we come forward with Marianne Seegard, more about the ways in which women are taken less seriously than men. We'll talk about the ways that they are disrespected online. And again, the media's role in this process when we come forward on KBLA Talk 1580. I love his big ego. It's
like this, cause he could back it up. Usually I'm humble, right now I don't choose.
Be sure to like and follow Tavis Smiley at The Real Tavis Smiley.
And get Twitter updates
at Tavis Smiley. The conversation continues when we come forward.
We knew you'd stick around. This is LA's home for progressive talk radio.
Be heard.
Welcome back to KBLA Talk 1580.
Marianne Seacart, we've established, I think, quite nicely, quite well in this conversation that women are taken less seriously in the workplace, but how are they treated online?
Oh, this is really depressing. Honestly, writing this chapter was so distressing. I can't tell you when I read about what actually happens to women online. So for a start, women are 27 times more likely to be abused online than men. 27 times. And that was proved by a research study where they put fictional characters into an internet forum and they randomly assigned them male or female names, but they said the same thing. And when they had a female name, they were 27 times more likely to be abused. And, you know, we're used to public figures, female public figures, you know, congresswomen and that sort of thing, being abused online. And that in itself is terrible. And they get rape threats and they get death threats and they get people saying, I know where you live and I'm going to come around and shoot you. I mean, that is absolutely terrible. But it's not just women in the public sphere. You can get a 13-year-old girl putting up a YouTube video about braiding her hair, and she'll get a rape threat in the comment section. And you just think, what kind of sicko is doing this and why? And so many of the threats are, you can tell they're deliberately aimed at silencing women. Mm. So, I mean, I'm guessing on live radio, I can't really enumerate them, but a lot of them are to do with putting really horrible things in women's mouths and gagging them one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's sort of oral rape, and there's, I'm going to cut your tongue out, I'm going to cut your head off, I'm going to, you know, what they want us to do is to shut up, basically. And they want to impose a tax on us speaking out in the public sphere. They want to say, you know, you dare speak out, and we're going to make your life so miserable, you're really going to regret it. And I think the reason I wrote this book at this stage in my life is that I've just decided I'm going to brave this because someone's got to. We've got to speak out on behalf of younger, more vulnerable women who haven't grown such a thick skin. Because if we don't speak out, we're just going to be cowed by the bullies. And I'm just not prepared to live with that.
Yeah. Speaking of online, is there an indictment of the media in this conversation about the ways that women are taken less seriously than men?
Yes, and in a much less extreme way. You know, I was only talking about extreme threats there online.
Sure.
But yes, the media really perpetuate this. And so the media are much more likely, for instance, to quote male experts and female experts in their news stories or on TV and radio. And that subliminally tells us that somehow men are more expert than women. Actually, in almost every field, if you actually bother to look, you will find there are women who are just as well qualified as men to talk about that particular subject. And the BBC here in the UK has undertaken to get to 50-50 women and men on screen as pundits and indeed as presenters and all sorts of other things. And they found it's really easy to do. You just have to make an effort to do it, because otherwise you're likely to default back to calling on the male scientist rather than the female scientist. And then it also plays itself out in who you get to present programs. Now, actually, you're rather better than we are in the UK about having older women on screen, and that may be because they've had so much work done to their face. You can't tell how old they are anyway. But, you know, we have older men on TV here whose face looks like a relief map of the Andes. They're still allowed on screen. Whereas, you know, the female presenters,
On that note, let me step aside one more time. And when we come forward, we'll have our remaining moments in conversation with Marianne Seacart and get to some good news here. The last chapter in her beautiful book is called No Need to Despair. You might be surprised about how men ultimately are happier when there's greater balance in how we treat women as compared to men. We'll get her remaining thoughts about that when we come forward on KBLA Talk 1580.
conversations that matter. You're listening to Tavis Smiley on KBLA Talk 1580.
So, Marianne, I've got a quick 2.5 minutes left in this conversation, but tell me why there's no need for us to despair despite all we've talked about in this hour, and how doing justice to women, respecting women, actually makes men happier.
I think that's why there's no need to despair, because we don't need to call on men to be altruistic or to suffer as a result of us doing better. Actually, it's in men's interest too. And this really cheered me up when I discovered this. So there's this research showing that both in more gender equal countries and more gender equal US states like California, and also in more gender equal relationships, where in straight relationships, that is, where the man and the woman share the household chores pretty equally and the childcare pretty equally, not only are the women happier and healthier, which you might expect, and the children are happier and healthier, and they do better at school, and they have fewer behavioral difficulties, and they get on better with their dad, but the men are happier and healthier too. So they are twice as likely to say they're satisfied with their lives, half as likely to be depressed, much less likely to get divorced. They tend to drink less, smoke less, take fewer drugs. They get better sleep at night. And here is the absolute clincher. They get more frequent and better sex. So, guys, what's not to like? If that's not an incentive, I don't know what is.
I think you sold all the men listening with your last comment. It took an hour to get there, but your last comment I think has sold all of us. The book is called The
Authority. I hope they're still listening.
They are. The book is called The Authority Gap: Why Women Are Still Taken Less Seriously Than Men and What We Can Do About It. The author is Marianne Sieghart, out now in paperback. Marianne, thanks for the book. Thanks for the conversation. Great to have you on. I enjoyed it immensely. I appreciate you.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure. And you can go to theauthoritygap.com.
And we will. Hour 3 of Tavis Smiley when we come forward after news and traffic on KBLA Talk 1580.
KBLA 1580 Santa Monica.